Hi, this is Dana Gardner, Principal Analyst at InterArbor Solutions, and you're listening to Briefings Direct. New threats to data security are emerging all the time. Bad players constantly seek new ways to get at and exploit sensitive data sources. This next Briefings Direct Data Security Insights discussion explores how data from one end of its life cycle to the other needs new protection and a means for rapid recovery. Stay with us now as we examine how even backup storage needs to be made safe and secure, especially if companies need to right themselves from an attack. To learn more, please join me now in welcoming our guests. We're here with Andrew Peters, Stealth Industry Director at Unisys. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you.
We're also here with George Perdell. He's Senior Systems Engineer at Dell EMC. Welcome, George.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for having us on today.
We're glad to have you. Andrew, let's start with you. What's changed in how data is being targeted? How are things different from, say, 3 years ago?
Well, one major thing that's changed, I think, in recent past has been the fact that bad guys have found out how to really monetize and extort money from organizations to meet their own ends. This has been something that has caught a lot of companies flat-footed in the sophistication of the attacks and, once again, their ability to extort money out of organizations.
George, same to you. How have you seen things change, and why is all data from one end of its life cycle to the other now needing to be reexamined?
Well, I think Andrew brings up some really good points. One of the things that we've seen out in the industry is we're seeing that there's actually ransomware as a service out there that folks can just dial in. There's SLAs on it and such. So everyone's data now is really at risk. And one of the things that we're seeing with some of these attacks, and we'll get into this, I'm sure, during our conversation, but what people are doing, they're getting a lot smarter. As soon as they go in to try to attack a customer, what do they go for first? They go for the backups, and they want to get rid of those because, hey, that's the kind of that 3D chess where you're kind of playing one step ahead. So things have changed quite a bit, Dana.
It's really difficult to put the squeeze on an organization knowing that they can recover themselves with their backup data. Obviously, so it the heat's on the bad guys to go after the backup systems and to pollute that with their malware just to keep companies from having the ability to recover themselves.
And that wasn't the case a few years ago.
You know, the attacks were so much different a few years ago. They were kind of what we call script kiddie attacks, where you basically get some malware. Maybe you do a denial of service attack or something. But now these are programmatized. And the big thing about it is that if you're a target once, chances are really good that the thief's going to keep coming back to you because it's easy money, as you know, Andrew pointed out.
All right. How has the topology changed? Now, people are backing up differently than they did a few years ago as well. We've got more cloud. We've got hybrid. We've got different strategies for managing dedupe and other redundancies. How has the storage topology and landscape changed that affects this equation of being secure?
In looking at how things have changed over the years, what we've seen is typically, you know, we started out in legacy systems, all the physical systems that many of us grew up with, and then virtualization came into play. And so now we had to change our backups and such, but virtualization offered up some great ways to do like image level backups and such. Now the big deal, we finally got into it. We started talking about it 10, 15 years ago about cloud, is that we've got, whether it's one of the public cloud vendors, a private cloud, how do we protect that data? Where is our data residing? Because privacy security is now part of the discussion when creating a hybrid cloud. This creates a lot of extra confusion, and confusion is actually where the thieves can really kind of zone in on. And so we want to make sure that no matter where that data is residing, that we're making sure that we protect that and we provide a pathway to bringing back that data that is air-gapped or, you know, one of our other technologies that helps to be able to keep this in place and, you know, allow for recoverability. Recoverability is really kind of the number one thing here, but it definitely has changed in these last few years.
And so, Andrew, what do you recommend to customers that may have thought that they had this problem solved, that they had their storage, they had their backup, they'd protected themselves from sort of the previous generation of security risk? Are you seeing a bit of unsureness out there in terms of how you need to reevaluate and when you need to reevaluate whether you are secure enough?
Well, there's a few things in this to take in consideration for any organization. And one is that they actually have an operation that can recover their data and bring their business back up and running. Because this is where you could get hit with a minor attack, or it's be something major and really turn into, like they say, a smoking hole in the middle of your data center. So how do you bring your organization back from that without having policies, a guidance, and a process, and the actual people in the systems to put this to work? Now, there's another thing, too, to consider. It's the efficacy of the data. I mean, is it clean? Because if you're backing up data that is already polluted with malware, guess what happens when you bring it back out and you recover your systems? It rehydrates itself within your systems, and you've still got the same problem you had before. And that's what the bad guys are paying attention to. That's what they want to have happen in an organization, which, you know, once again, it's a hand they can play. If the malware can still come out of the backup systems and rehydrate itself and repollute the systems when an organization is going through its recovery, it's not only going to hamper the business in the time to recover and cost them, but it's also going to force them to pay the ransoms and what have you that the bad guys are extorting.
And to be clear, this is the case across both the public and the private sector. We're hearing about ransomware attacks in lots of cities and towns. This is an equal opportunity risk. Isn't that the case, George?
Yeah. Malware and bad guys don't discriminate. Sorry, I cut you off, George.
No worries. You're exactly right about that. One of the customers that I've worked with recently is that they've got a large city and they got hit with a ransomware attack. Now, one of the things about ransomware attacks is they typically want you to pay in Bitcoin. Well, who's got, you know, $100,000 worth of Bitcoin sitting around? But let's kind of take it to what really happens and why this is so important that we find ways to eliminate these types of attacks. If you've got a governmental situation, then if you get attacked, one of the problems is that chaos ensues. In one particular situation, the police department in their police cars were not able to pull up license plates on the computer so that they could check to see if that car that they were pulling over just had a couple of bad tickets, or perhaps the person was wanted for some reason. And so it actually is a very dangerous situation that you've now put into play for all these officers. So that's just one tiny example of how these kind of things can really proliferate. And like you said, whether it's public sector, whether it's private sector, if you're a soft target, chances are at some point you're going to get hit with the ransomware.
All right, let's look at some of the solutions. I think it's very clear now the extent of the problem, the fact that it's a fast-moving and that they're adaptive out there. What are we doing differently in terms of the solutions now than we were doing a few years ago in order to head this off and especially to get people backing up and running and make sure that those are clean and usable data when they do so? Let's start with you, Andrew. What's part of the solution that we need to think about that's different from a few years ago?
Well, there's a lot of security has always been predicated on the concept of a perimeter of something where we can put up guards, gates, and guns and in a moat, and there's an inside and there's an outside, and it's generally recognized today that doesn't really exist. And so one of the new moves in security that's been happening is this: let's defend the endpoint, let's defend the application. And to do that, there's a technology called microsegmentation, which is becoming more and more talked about and more popular, because that allows you to put a security perimeter and a policy around each endpoint. And if it's done correctly, it's something you can scale to hundreds to thousands to hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of endpoints, devices, applications, servers, and virtually anything you have in an environment. And so that's when big change is the concept of let's secure the endpoint, let's secure the application, let's secure the storage, each one with its own distinct security policy.
And George, how do you see it changing, perhaps more towards the holistic infrastructure side, not just the endpoint issues?
Yeah, you know, I think with some of these things, one of the tenets that Andrew just kind of related to is something called security by obscurity. And that's kind of an old basic tenet, is that if you can't see it, think about a safe in your house. If the safe is back behind the bookcase, you're the only person that knows it's there. That's an extra level of security. Well, there's ways that we can do that with technology. So you're seeing a lot of these different types of technologies being employed. Many of them are not new types of security security technologies, and many of them are, we're kind of going back to what's worked in the past, and we're taking that, and it's a nice, firm, stable platform to be building some of these new technologies on. Now we add on automation, and with that automation, we can do a lot of these things without as much user intervention, and that's a big part of this. If any type of security that you're using has too much user intervention, then it's very hard for the company to cost justify those types of resources.
I suppose something that isn't different from the past is that having that Swiss Army knife approach of multiple layers of security, different tools that you can employ, looking at this as a team sport where you want to bring as many people to bear on the problem as possible still makes sense. And that, of course, leads me to want to learn more about the Unisys and Dell EMC combination. You've brought different strengths together in order to create a whole greater than the sum of the parts. Andrew, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Unisys-Dell combo, and then we can get into a little bit deeper of how that works in these newer problem situations.
Well, one thing that's fantastic that Dell has done is they put together a cyber recovery solution. And this is so when there's a meltdown in a company or some form of recovery, that you have gold copies of critical data that's required to reestablish a business and bring it back up and get into operation. And they developed this to be automated, to contain immutable copies of data, and to assure the efficacy of the data in there. Now, this is a great operation. And the way they've set this up with the air gapping, so it is virtually isolated from any other network operations. So bad guys that are hovering around in the network would have a terrible time of trying to even touch this thing. But what we've done with Unisys is to put what we call a cryptographic wrapper around that using our microsegmentation technology called Stealth. And what this does is it creates a cryptographic air gap that virtually disappears that vault and its recovery operations from anything else in the network if they don't have a cryptographic key. They have a cryptographic key that was authorized, they could talk to it. If they don't, they can't. So any bad guys, any malware, they can't see. If they can't see, they can't touch, they can't hack. And this turns into an extraordinarily secure means to be able to recover an organization's operations.
Now, George, as you pointed out, the economics of this is so critical. No one's going to be concerned about an attack if they can recover from it before there's the notice of damage. Tell us a little bit about how your technology combination, in effect, takes the economic incentive away from these nefarious players.
So when we're talking about the economics of this type of situation, number one, if you have a way to be able to recover from this, all of a sudden the bad guys are going to say like, oh, shoot, you know, well, we're not going to get any money out of these guys. And as far as that goes, you're not going to be a constant target. Now, one of the things that you find out is that they're going to go after your backups and such. And that's one of the things that I hope Andrew will expound upon a little bit, because Stealth can actually hide some of the targets that these people go after. And some of the other pieces to the economics of it is that once you've put this type of a cyber recovery solution in place, you can rest a lot easier at night, because one of the things of part of the cyber recovery solution is that we actually expect malware to get into the cyber recovery vault. And people shake their head and they go, wait, George, what do you mean about that? It's like, yes, malware, we want to get it into the cyber recovery vault. And then we have ways to do analytics to see whether our point in times are good, so that when we're doing that restore, as Andrew talked about earlier, we're making sure we're restoring a nice, clean environment back to the production environment. So when you're looking at these types of solutions, it is an extra expense, but you have to, you know, weigh the risks for your organization. And what does it really cost if you had a cyber recovery incident? And one of the things that I would also add, Dana, that some people may not be totally versed on is the fact that you have disaster recovery situation is different than a cyber recovery situation. Because disaster recovery may be some sort of a physical problem where you've had some sort of maybe a tornado hits and wipes out a facility or whatever. Cyber recovery, we're talking about files that now have been encrypted, and the only way to get this data back and get back up and running is by employing some sort of a cyber recovery solution, such as the Unisys and Dell EMC solution.
Andrew, for those organizations who perhaps think that they're a small to medium size or they're not the right character for this, I'm just wondering whether this dual tag team solution between Unisys and Dell EMC is is appropriate and applicable to all kinds of business, including, say, cloud providers, managed service providers. Where's the sweet spot and what's the extension in terms of the market for these products?
This is one of the things that's really difficult to measure in security is the ROI. It always has been. We have methodologies to, we actually have a tool that we can use to measure risk and probability and financial exposure for an organization. So you can actually use the same methodologies that insurance companies use to underwrite organizations for things like cybersecurity and virtually anything else based on the reality of the fact that there's a strong likelihood that there's going to be a security breach. There's going to be perhaps a disastrous security breach, and it's going to really hurt the organization. And the way we see this is organizations, and the one thing we really like about this solution is that it's like plan on the fact it's probably going to happen, and you need to invest in your systems and your recovery. If you think that you can sustain a complete meltdown of your company and go out of operation for weeks to months, then you probably don't need to put money into it. If you understand the fact and how exposed that you potentially are, and the fact that the bad guys are starting with the low-hanging fruits, they may be state governments, they may be cities, they may be other things that are less protected. As they improve the protection, they're going to start going after other organizations and operations, one. Two, the fact is the bad guys are extraordinarily patient. If your payoff is in the tens of millions of dollars potentially, you might spend, as the bad guys did with Sony, years mapping systems, learning how an operation works, and understanding their complete operations before you actually take action, and potentially in the most disastrous way possible. So ergo, it's hard to put a number on that. An organization will have to decide of how much they have to lose, how much they have at risk, and what the probability is that they're actually going to get hit with an attack.
George, also important on this applicability as to, you know, where it's the right fit is that automation and skills. What sort of organizations typically will go at this, and what sort of skills are required? How do we make this as user-friendly, if you will, for the IT and the security infrastructure people?
That's definitely been the basis for our cyber recovery solution, is we've written a number of APIs to be able to automate different pieces of a recovery situation. We'll kind of talk a little bit about what pieces are involved if you have a cyber recovery incident, because it's not a matter of just, okay, I've got the data, now I can restore it. We've got a lot of experts in the field that what they do is they figure out exactly where the attack came from, how it came in, what was affected, those types of things. So one of the things that we're looking for is to make it as simple as possible for the administration. We've done a lot of work creating APIs that automate items such as recovering backup servers, taking a look. We take point-in-time copies of the data. And one of the things that I don't want to go into too deep on it, but our data domain technology is the basis for this. And the reason why it's important to note that is because of the replication that we do is based upon our variable length deduplication. Now, that may sound a little gobbledygook, but what that means is that we have the smallest replication times that you could have for a certain amount of data. So when we're taking data into the cyber recovery vault, we are reducing what's called our dwell time. And this is the area where you would have someone that could see that you had a connection open. But a big part of this is so that on a day-to-day basis, I'm not concerned. I don't have a whole team of people that are maintaining this cyber recovery vault. Typically, with our customers, they already have the understanding of how our base technology works. And so that part is very straightforward. And what we have is we have automation. We have policies that are set up in the cyber recovery vault that will, on a regular basis, pull the data, whatever has changed from the production environment. Typically, it's once a day. And, you know, kind of a rule of thumb for some people that might be thinking, this sounds really interesting, but like, how much data would I put in this? Typically, you know, we'll do 10 to 15% of a customer's production environment might go into the cyber recovery vault. So we want to make this as simple as possible. We want to automate as much as possible. And on the other side of it, when there is an incident, we want to be able to also automate that part, because that is when all heck is going on. And if anyone, you know, that's listening to this has ever been involved in one of those situations, it's not always your clearest thinking moment. So automation is your best friend and can help you get back up and running as quickly as possible.
George, Run us through an example, if you would, of how this works in the real world, perhaps an organization that's been through this, so we have a better understanding of the total process and the total value.
So basically what will happen is that at some point, somebody clicks on that doggone attachment that was on that email that had a free trip to Hawaii or something in it, and all it had was a link to some ransomware. Once the security folks have determined that there has been an attack, sometimes it's very obvious. There's one attack where there's a giant scary skeleton that comes up on your screen and basically says, gotcha, and then gives instructions on how you would go about sending them the money so that they can get your data back. However, sometimes it's not quite so obvious. But, you know, let's say your security folks have determined there has been an attack, and then the first thing that you would want to do is that you would want to access the cyber recovery, provided you've done all the great job of putting the cyber recovery vault with stealth in, but you would go into the cyber recovery vault and you would lock down the vault. And the way that you do that is it's so simple and straightforward. We talked about this a little earlier about the way we do the automation is you click on the lock. That locks everything down. It stops any future replications from coming in. And then what the process would be is that while the security team is looking to find what the situation is, to find out how bad it is, what was affected, one of the things that this team can do is the cyber recovery team is to go in and to be able to run some analysis. If you haven't done so already, you can automate this type of analysis, but let's say you haven't done that. And let's say you have 30 point in times, so one for each day throughout the last month. You might want to check and run an analysis against maybe the last five of those to be able to see whether or not those are come up as suspicious or whether those come up as okay. The way that that's done is that we look at the entropy of the different point in time backups. One thing to note is that you do not have to rehydrate the backup in order to analyze the backup. So let's say you backed it up with Avamar and then you wanted to analyze that backup. You don't have to rehydrate that in the vault in order to get that backup and running. Once that's done, then there's a lot of different ways that you can decide to do this. If you've got, let's say, your physical machines, but those physical machines are not in great shape, they're suspect in that, but the physical parts of it are okay, you could then decide that at some point you're going to reload those machines with the gold copies are very typical to have in the vault and then put the data and such on it. If you've got image level backups that are in the vault, those are very easy to get back up and running on an ESX host or a Hyper-V host that you have in your production environment. So there's a lot of different ways that you can do that. The whole idea, though, is that, and I'll turn it over to Andrew to kind of give a little bit more detail, is that our typical cyber recovery solution, one of the things that we've done is we've air-gapped it, and we recommend to customers that they have a whole separate set of physical controls as well as the software controls. Now, one of that may not be practical in all situations, and so that's when we look to stealth to say, hey, can we provide, as Andrew put it, kind of that virtual air gap by installing the pieces from stealth in it? And I don't know, Andrew, did you want to add a couple things onto that part of it?
Yeah, George, yeah, that's great. Oftentimes when you have an operation like this, and things I learned in working with the United States Air Force Information Warfare Center was the fact that you can build the most incredibly secure operation in the world, and humans will do things to change it. And what we do with stealth is we allow organizations to be able to get access into the vault from a management perspective, to do analytics, and also from a recovery perspective, because anytime there's a change to the way that vault operates, that's an opportunity for bad guys to find a way in. Because once again, they're targeting these systems. They know they're there. They could be watching them. And they can be spending years doing this and watching that in the operations. One thing we do with stealth is we remove the option or the opportunity for human error in that. One, two, we remove the visibility that any bad guys or any malware that would be inside a network to observe the fact that you actually had a vault and that there's any activities going on at all. They may see data flowing, but they don't know what it's going to. They don't know what it's for. They can't read it because it's going to be encrypted. And they're not going to be able to actually even see the endpoints because they'll never be able to get an address on them because we are cryptographically disappearing or hiding or cloaking, whatever word you'd like to use. We're actively actually removing those from visibility from anything else in the network unless it's specifically authorized.
All right, let's look to the future. As we pointed out earlier in our discussion, there's a sort of spy versus spy, dog chasing the cat, whatever you want to use as a metaphor. One side of the battle is adjusting constantly and the other is reacting to that. So as we move to the future, are there any other perhaps analytics, Andrew, that we can bring? Will more machine learning about these attacks help prevent them? How will we be able to always stay one step ahead of the threat?
That's a really good point, is that we already, with our technology, we already embody machine learning in there, and we can do responses to isolate attacks. We call it dynamic isolation, to where a device could be misbehaving, and we could change its policy and be able to either restrict what it's able to communicate with or cut it off altogether until it's been examined and determined to be safe for the environment. So we can take that and we can provide a lot of automation, a lot of visibility, and machine speed reaction in response to threats as they're happening. So they don't get that, malware doesn't get that 20-second head start. We might be able to cut off in 10 seconds and be able to make a dynamic change to the threat surface.
Same question to you, George. What's in the future that's going to allow you to stay always one step ahead of the bad guys? And I'm also curious, George, if there's an advantage for organizations that are doing a lot of desktop as a service or virtual desktops. Do they have an advantage in having that data center, you know, image of all of the clients that will put them in an advantage when it comes to these sorts of attacks?
Oh, yeah, definitely. How do we kind of stay in front of the bad guys? Well, you kind of have to think like the bad guys. So one of the things that you want to do is that you want to reduce your attack surface. That's a big part of it. And that's why also the technology that we use to analyze the backups, looking for malware, one of the things that it does is that it uses 100 different types of objects of entropy. So as we're going through this, we're doing machine learning of that data of what's normal, what's not normal, and so that we can go ahead and we can figure out exactly where the issues are there to stay ahead of them. Now, an air gap, just kind of on its own surface, is that air gap is extremely secure because of the fact that it keeps that data in an environment where no one can get at it. And actually, you know, we've got situations where stealth has actually helped with, quote, an air gap situation where a particular general might have three different networks that they need to connect to. And stealth is a fantastic solution for that. If you're doing, you know, desktop as a service, you're doing that type of thing, there's a lot of different ways that it can help in that situation. We're always looking at where's the data reside. And most of the time in those situations, the data is going to reside back at the corporate infrastructure. And that's a very easy place to be able to protect data. When the data is out on laptops and things like that, then it makes it a little bit more difficult, not impossible at all, but you've got a lot of different endpoints that you're pulling from and such. And so in order to be able to bring the system back up, if you're using virtual desktops, that kind of thing, actually it's pretty straightforward to be able to do that, because that environment, chances are they're not going to bring down the virtual desktop environment. They're going to encrypt the data. Now, that said, one of the things that, you know, when we're having these conversations, it's not as straightforward of a conversation as talk about, you know, how long might you be out of business depending upon what you've implemented and such. And what's going on there that's a little difficult is, you know, I would just ask whoever I was talking to, say like, okay, well, which malware attack are you going to get hit with? And of course, I'm like, well, I don't know. So, well, that's exactly it. So what we have to do is we have to engineer for all the different types of malware attack. And what's the common denominator? It's the data. The data, keeping that data safe, keeping that data so it can't be deleted. One of the things that we have is we have a retention lock capability that you could lock that up for up to 70 years, and it takes two administrators in order to be able to unlock it. That's the kind of thing that makes it, you know, in the old days, we would do a worm drive, and we would copy stuff off to a CD, what have you, in order to make something immutable. This is a great way to do it, and that's one way to kind of stay ahead of the bad guys as best as we can.
Well, very good. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. You've been listening to a sponsored Briefings Direct discussion on how data from one end of its life cycle to the other needs protection and a means for rapid recovery. And we've learned how an alliance between Dell EMC and Unisys helps protect storage, including backup data, and further assist companies in making themselves whole again after such an attack when they've taken the proper precautions. So please join me in thanking our guests. We've been here with Andrew Peters, Stealth Industry Director at Unisys. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
And we've been here with George Pradel, Senior Systems Engineer at Dell EMC. Thank you so much, George.
All right. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate the time.
And a big thank you as well to our audience for joining this Briefings Direct Data Security Insights discussion. I'm Dana Gardner, Principal Analyst at InterArbor Solutions, your host throughout this series of Unisys-sponsored Briefings Direct discussions. Thanks again for listening. Please pass this along to your community and do come back next time.